faith in the news media has been challenged, making it even harder to get stories told. The Friday Reporter podcast was created to help audiences better understand the media by hosting journalists who will answer the questions to which we need answers. Join me every Friday to hear more. Well, hello, and thank you so much for joining me for another episode of the Friday Reporter podcast. Today's episode is with, possibly my favorite podcaster. I have listened to the episodes and the great work that has been done by Lillian Cunningham and her team at the Washington Post now for, oh my gosh, for as long as I can remember. So I'm thrilled today to be hosted and joined by Lillian Cunningham, who is, by all accounts, just a little bit of everything for the Washington Post, an audio enterprise reporter, podcast host, and creator. Lillian, thanks so much for being with me.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to be talking with you, Lisa. Thank you.
So the fun thing about today's conversation is not only do we get to talk about your process and how you've built some of the, I think, some of the most compelling and interesting podcasts I have listened to, from presidential to constitutional to Moonrise, and now a new podcast launching this week, the last week of June in 2023, if you're not listening right on time, called Field Trip. So Lillian, you have to tell me, all of these are just the most remarkable content and information. I always learn so much, and they keep me engaged and really sort of wanting to listen to the next episode, which I think is just a real talent. Talk to me a little bit about your process. How in the world did you end up being this podcast reporter and producer and creator for the Post?
Sure. Well, and thank you. That is all very, very kind. I kind of stumbled my way into this. I went to journalism school thinking I would be a print reporter. And I've been at the Post now 13 years. Worked somewhere else a little bit before that, but my early time at the Post was as a print reporter and editor. And when I say print, you know, obviously I mean a lot of various things digitally too. But sure. But it was text based. Mm-hmm. And in 2015, I was thinking about the presidential election that was coming up, and just for my own sake, I thought, like, wouldn't it be really cool if there were a podcast where I could like brush up on my presidential history? And I feel like I only know a little bit about Lincoln and TR, but like I have these huge gaps in my sort of like deep presidential knowledge. And going into a new election year, it just felt like a nice time to brush up. And I realized there was nothing like that out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, being within the Washington Post newsroom and knowing that it's a place that's like game to experiment and to think about, especially, you know, in more recent years, they've, I think, been very open to innovation in the type of storytelling they do. And I pitched this idea to the editor-in-chief at the time, Marty Baron, of a podcast that would play out over the course of 2016, once a week, one president per week, starting with George Washington, and the math would perfectly work out that I would get through the Obama episode by election day. And I knew absolutely nothing about audio. I had no idea how much work it would be to make that 44 episode podcast in 44 weeks. But frankly, the Post didn't either. They didn't have an audio department at the time. They didn't have really any other podcasts at the time.
Right.
And it was grueling, but it was also just so much fun to do. I learned so much. I loved audio as like a storytelling platform. Mm-hmm. Ever since I made that first presidential podcast for the Post in 2016, I've kind of squarely moved over to audio. And now the Post has like a full-fledged audio team. As you mentioned, I've done several more podcasts since then. I kind of just sideways stepped my way into it out of just my own like curiosity and wish that something like that existed for me as a news consumer.
For sure.
First and foremost.
And so because it was so many episodes and so much work, for presidential, especially, and a big learning curve too, right? Because everybody was really sort of figuring this out on the fly and delivering. How much time did it take? I mean, I'm sure it was different for every episode, but like the production of each episode alone, I have to imagine that there was a lot of work because there's a lot of, it's not just Lillian Cunningham reading to the broader audience. You bring in these like historians and you bring in people that have points of view or maybe even folks that have some familiarity with the history behind the president. There's all of these characters and like smart, different voices that come into the conversation. And then also it's produced in a beautiful and professional way. That's not a 1 week project. Like that's a lot of work. So to get that all together and get it delivered in time for the election, can you give me a window into that process? Like that's a lot of work.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
Yeah, it was, I would say, a once-in-a-lifetime amount of work.
Yeah, good for you.
I could not replicate it because it was actually all done in real time. So, you know, I made the George Washington episode the first week of January. I made the John Adams episode the second week. And
my gosh,
there was no wiggle room. So it, and I, you know, I didn't have any help with that at the time. So I will say I spent a lot of time just even figuring out in the early weeks, like how to edit audio, like how to use some of that technical part of things.
Yeah.
But yeah, so in a given week, I, it's all a little bit of a blur, but to the extent
like working
that
on your own personal campaign.
You know, I would dedicate usually the first day or two of the week to finding the people to interview, you know, crash reading every book I could about the president of the week, and all of the reporting. Then I would do recordings for a couple days, then edits for a couple days. And that would kind of round out the week and click publish and then start again. And I try, as I got a little better, I got to into a groove where I could like start thinking ahead a little bit, right? Like, oh, the Reagan episode is coming up. Why don't I start lining up interviews or putting out feelers a couple of weeks before? But for the most part, it was all done in a single week, which I mean, I will say I literally had a sleeping bag that I kept under my desk at work.
And oh my gosh.
Most well, it's of my sharp. Recording.
The work was amazing. I mean, obviously nominated for awards and appreciated and heralded by so many. And then, of course, you moved on to Constitutional, which was really super relevant and really, really good stuff during the last presidential administration, and then Moonrise, which, I mean, it was a 2019 Apple Best Podcast recognition, and it talked about sort of the race to get to the moon, which to me still, like, it's the soundtrack of my summer, the summer that it released, because we listened to it on every car ride, my husband and I. And so now we're moving into this new series, and I really want you to tell me, a little bit, because it launches, I know, this week, and there's a lot of people that have contributed, obviously, even like we were talking about before we even got on to record, the show art even is a contribution by someone at the Post. So tell me about Field Trip and what can we look forward to hearing?
Yeah, I mean, it is a testament to just how quickly and dramatically I think audio work at the Post has grown, because I went from being truly the only person basically working on the presidential podcast to, for this podcast, which is about the national parks, having just like a great team of people at the Post who've been working on it with me, two producers, a couple editors, graphic designers at the Post who've made like incredible podcast art for it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so this, like my, in kind of the spirit of the other podcasts I've done, to me, the national parks are this like big chapter of both American history, but also sort of like American mythology, like that, you know, everyone sort of like has some touch points with, like most people have been to at least a national park, or if they haven't, you know, the like the images of the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone are kind of like seared in to your head. And yet I felt like, as with, well, for me, at least I'll say, you know, the presidency, constitutional history, the space race, I felt like I had kind of a just surface level knowledge, like that you get just from going through
elementary school in America.
But I couldn't actually anyway, the national parks are just like, they're something I love, but where I felt like I didn't actually deeply understand the stories of them. And so this podcast, I mean, I will say, is very different in that it is 5 episodes, not 44.
Oh, wow.
But we've taken essentially the same amount of time to make it. I mean, we've spent the past year working on it, and I went on these deep, long reporting trips to 5 different national parks where there are just urgent, fascinating, important stories playing out at these places today. And the idea was to really take a look at, you know, what it will take to protect these places that are so kind of integral to American identity into the future. And in many cases, look at how the history of these parks actually tells us a lot about why many of them are facing challenges and crises today. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we like to, or we often think about national parks as like these like almost amusement parks, right? Like they're bubbles of wilderness. You think you just kind of like drive in through the gate, you're in a special like boundaried area where everything's like a perfect mountain picture. But really so many of these parks, you know, between climate change, pressures from like industrial development, they're facing like big questions about how we best protect them. And also interesting questions, like I will say one of the big themes we explore in this series is the relationship between the tribes who traditionally lived on those lands and the Park Service today, and ways that the U.S. government is trying, I think, harder than ever before, especially since there's now for the first time a Native director of the Park Service. There's like a real effort right now to rethink the relationship that Native people have with these lands. So just a lot of really interesting questions there that I feel like give us an opportunity both to look back into the history of these places, how they came to be protected, why they were set aside as national parks, and also like look, you know, with an eye toward the future about what the biggest opportunities and sort of challenges are for them.
I love that. I love that. And I haven't seen nearly enough of them myself. Obviously make a point to try to get to see as much of that as we can, but it is so incredibly fun and exciting for you to do this, especially to launch during the summer when people will be out and about and traveling and perhaps even visiting some of these places. So super, super excited to listen. And only 5 episodes. So where did you go? Where did you travel when you were out and about?
We went to Yosemite in California, to Glacier in Montana, to the Everglades in Florida, to White Sands in New Mexico, and Gates of the Arctic in Alaska. So
cool.
We tried geographically for a spread. We tried for a spread in terms of how long those parks have been part of the national park system. Mm-hmm. Like White Sands only became a national park in 2019.
Oh, interesting.
Yosemite is one of our earliest national parks. And the hope is that, and I should say they're all really sound rich and immersive. So the hope is like, yeah, definitely if you're taking a road trip to Yosemite, listen to it. But also if you're like working all summer and you can't go anywhere, they're like designed to be really transportive.
I love that.
Yeah. Interesting episodes to listen to where it's like, I mean, in Everglades, you like hear alligator sounds.
Oh my
throughout
gosh.
The whole episode.
You oh wow.
Hear the birds.
That's amazing.
The mud we're sloshing through. So they're really designed to like drop you into the heart of the park.
I absolutely love it. And I love that. I love that sound is something that, I mean, because people still very much, I had a guest on the show a couple months back who said that as much as we talk on television, it's more of a broadcast to a large audience. Podcasting and radio is still a very personal connection. So you feel as if you are having a conversation with really just one person, even though you're broadcasting out to so many. So to listen to your the podcast that you've produced in the past, and I can't wait to listen to this new one. To me, I can sense and really sort of understand your own personal curiosity, which is I think is what makes your show and the way you do this work so fun to listen to, because I feel as if I'm on the journey with you, right? I'm sort of like listening and I'm learning and I'm having these conversations, even just as an eavesdropper. So it feels it's a very connective experience for any of your podcasts that I've listened to. So I'm sure, especially with the sound and the actual sort of being in the space, would be a really fun way to learn more about that. So there are so many other, I mean, millions of other podcasts in the world, right? I mean, I this little podcast obviously broadcast out of Alexandria, Virginia, just down the street from where you live too. I'm waving at you to your home from here. are there things that you listen to? Are there podcasts? Are there other sort of broadcasts that interest you or sort of inspire you or give you ideas? The answer can be no, I'm exclusive to the Washington Post and I don't want to answer that question. But I'm curious, though, as someone who is producing such great and rich content, where do you derive some of your inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, I will say I always feel a little embarrassed to say this, but I guess I should embrace it. Maybe that I am not quite like a lot of my podcasting and radio colleagues where it's like, I am all audio all the time. I mean, I have people I work with who I think are all the better for it. They listen to like
everything.
I don't even know how they have the time in the day to listen to everything they do, but they are such deep audio consumers. I find I do listen to podcasts. I actually listen to audiobooks quite a lot when I am on like long road trips. But I also am, you know, a big reader. Like mm-hmm. I still love print. I mean, to me, I think, I feel like I'm a very visual person. So like, right. You know, the podcast art is important to me too. I hope that that's actually become sort of an asset in audio storytelling. And I think in some ways it's a funny thing, but because of sort of audio work I do is so narrative, a lot of it is actually about being able to paint a picture mm-hmm. in someone's head of where we are.
Yeah.
You know, they can't see the mountain. They can't see the swamp we're in the middle of the Everglades, and we have sound, but so much of what I do with the writing of the episodes is try to help people picture it. So I find that, you know, it is still really helpful to my work to still be just a big consumer of like great narrative writing.
Yeah. And everybody's process is different. That's why I sort of ask, like, where do you get your inspiration? And if that's the case, I mean, then that's very true. Like when you read a book, a great book does that for you. You don't need to see it because they've just done a beautiful job of describing it and giving you sort of a sense, like almost as if you're there and experiencing it yourself. So that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. And you think about like, what are the best places to let people's, you know, imagination sort of fill in the rest. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So when you're not producing and you're not coming up with new, great, cool, fun ideas, what books are you reading, or what kinds of things are you consuming that you could share with the audience?
Yeah, well, I will say I'm the kind of person who, like, when I'm working on one of these projects, I just like it truly becomes my life. I have stacks of books all around me right now. But they are truly, like, they all relate to national parks in some way. But I mean, I will say I have like a couple of recommendations for great national parks books.
Do, yes, please.
National park books. So one of them that I've just found like so interesting is called The Swamp. And it's actually by a former Washington Post reporter, Michael Grunwald, who then also went on to work for The Times and Politico. But he did a bunch of reporting for the Post on the Army Corps of Engineers and got just completely fascinated with the work the Army Corps of Engineers did to drain the Everglades.
Oh, interesting.
And wrote this long, very definitive, really fascinating history about the Everglades. And, you know, it's a story of the Everglades, but it is also a story just of like the development of South Florida. And it was so helpful for me in working on this Everglades episode. And it's fascinating. I mean, I will say it's dense, but it's also like a total page turner.
That's
like,
awesome.
And I think for anyone who likes reading nonfiction narrative history, is just such a great book.
Oh, that's awesome to know. And it's like it's a place where we all, of course, as kids, obviously I grew up in the Northeast, so we always ended up somewhere at some point during my childhood. A trip to Florida was always in the cards. I have not myself ever been, and I have like a natural curiosity about it. Like, so that would be a great read. And so I've got it on my list of things to check out. I have to ask, so before podcasting, obviously, 2 Emmy Awards for the work that you did on leadership for the Post, also a stint at the embassy in Paris. Is that right?
Oh,
as an intern?
I went a little bit deep.
I have to ask, that must have been very, so you did an internship for the embassy, internship for MSNBC, which is, as far as I can still remember, is in Secaucus, New Jersey. So from Paris to Secaucus, that's kind of a shock and awe, unbelievable change. Tell me a little bit about your form, like you went to journalism school, obviously. Tell me a little bit about those early experiences for you and how they informed what you do today.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the way I kind of found myself interested in journalism is that I found myself interested in a lot of different things and unable to decide what I wanted to do, and then realized journalism was the way to get around that, to just continue to learn new things, feel like, you know, writing, storytelling, reporting is kind of the fundamental tools of what I do, but like the actual substance of what I'm doing, you know, changes regularly. And so it just like kept me actively curious and learning new things all the time. So yeah, I mean, when I did the internship at the embassy in Paris through the State Department, you know, that was a phase where I was like particularly interested in international affairs, and knew I would be going off to journalism school, but kind of couldn't help myself from...
How could you not? What a cool experience. Okay, so, but in that experience, like how rich and fascinating to be there and to be able to get that experience and get that maybe a little bit of a point of view too, perspective of having left the US and to work for the State Department for some time.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly living abroad is always eye-opening and enriching. And I do think actually that as a journalist, it was also really useful for me to have a little bit of time working within the government. Yeah. Like, I mean, I was just an intern, but it gave me a sense of just like how the bureaucracy works, how like a little bit of a window into decision-making. And I don't know. I mean, I certainly think as a journalist, like the more varied experiences you can have in your life, the better. You know, a big part of, to me, being a good reporter is about being, it's kind of weird to use the word empathetic, but like being able to see people's perspectives, to like really be able to just put yourself in someone else's shoes and understand why they might have made the decisions they made or hold the perspective they have. So I think the more, especially, you know, earlier in your career, you can expose yourself personally to like as many varied experiences as possible, the more you are able to like move through the work of reporting and
that makes a ton of sense. And especially now when reporting is a little bit of everything. I mean, you've said that in throughout the course of our conversation today. I mean, it's a little bit of writing. It's a lot of storytelling. It can be audio. It can be video. It can be written. A lot of it's digital. People consume information in so many different ways that providing them a lot of different opportunities to consume that information and to understand it through the lens of a journalist like yourself, who is trying to sort of connect and understand points of view beyond sort of maybe where you come to the conversation with a bias, because there's always that, you know, from folks from the outside looking in, they always assume that a journalist comes to a conversation with a bias. And you and I both know that that is actually the opposite of the way journalists hope to come to conversations, because they want to have a conversation that is reflective of different points of view and different ideas. So that's also so cool. So with the production of Field Trip this week, we're going to have a couple of episodes come out, and then the next few after that will come out weekly. So we'll keep following that and keeping a close eye. And we'll do everything we can to share. I'll make sure they're in the show notes and everybody can listen in, because I can't wait to listen, and I'll be sure to share with my audience as well. Tell me, Lillian, as we get to the end of our conversation today, is there a journalist? Is there someone you work with? Is there someone that you think might be interesting for a future episode of the podcast?
Well, you've already interviewed my husband, which would be my first required recommendation since he's also a journalist. You know, I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm just shilling for the post, but I do think, I think it would be really interesting for you to interview my colleague, Martine Powers, who's the host of, or now co-host of the Post's daily news podcast, Post Reports. But she's also been hard at work on a podcast series that's going to come out in the fall, looking back at the US invasion of Grenada. And her parents are from living Grenada. And
interesting.
She's been doing this really fascinating investigation of it. And she's just such a thoughtful, wonderful person and reporter.
That's amazing. So
if you're ready to have another Post person in rotation.
I am. Look, I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky. And I have to give credit, because I wasn't going to bring it up, but your husband was the first text I sent when I first 2.5 years ago thought, what if I had a podcast where I talked to journalists? Would that be interesting? Would anybody do the show? And I texted Jim Tankersley and I said, if I were to host a podcast where I talk to journalists, would you be a guest? And he said, yes. And so I give him a little bit of credit for being the first guy to say, yeah, go for it. What's the, I mean, and my joke always, I've probably made it 1,000 times on the show, is like, at least I know my father would listen to the show. And then we could put it back up on blocks and be like, wasn't that fun when Lisa tried to have a podcast? So, but no, Martine would be wonderful. And obviously the greatest thing about this show is that there are so many remarkable journalists in this town alone in Washington, D.C. that I could spend, I mean, obviously I've just finished a June takeover with The Hill and News Nation. I've had lots of your tremendous colleagues at The Post. I'm always happy to have other recommendations. And also too, to have someone like yourself say to Martine, yes, I've done Lisa's show and she's someone that you might like to talk to, is a great endorsement. Lillian, I am so incredibly grateful for your time today. I cannot wait to listen to Field Trip. I can't wait to get it out there and share it with folks. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
And there you have it, another episode of the Friday Reporter podcast in partnership with PR Daily and coming soon to a platform near you on Big Wave Podcasts. See you next week.